Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host Laura Chan Baker.
Hello.
Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the floating pleasure craft that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we're going through our open tab, so we'll be discussing fine literature on Instagram, the intersection of art and architecture, and managing conflict and breakdowns in the workplace. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our very special guest, Ben Law. Ben writes books, TV screenplays, columns, essays, and feature journalism. He slices, he dices, he even makes julienne fries. Did you guys get that ad at all here?
I got no clue what you're talking
about. Okay, that means nothing to anyone.
No, I actually watched a lot of infomercials, and I know exactly what you're talking
about.
Thank
you.
There we go.
He's the author of the memoir, The Family Law, which is now an award-winning TV series for SBS, the travel book Geisha, Adventures in the Queer East, and the quarterly essay on safe schools, Moral Panic 101. He is the co-author of Should Asian Mothers Say with his sister Michelle and the sex relationships advice book Law School with his mum Jenny. In addition to having written for almost every publication in Australia and beyond, every week Ben co-hosts ABC Radio National's weekly national pop culture show Stop Everything and online startup and tech TV show That Startup Show. You can also watch him on TV shows like ABC's Q&A and SBS's Filthy Rich and Homeless. Long story short, we bagged a legit television personality, and we're delighted to welcome him as he makes his whirlwind trip to Melbourne from his home in Sydney. Ben, welcome to the show. We promise not to reenact any scenes from Misery with you while you're in the office. How are you?
I'm really, really well. But if you want to enact Misery role play, that's totally my kink.
Well, I've been watching Family Law recently, so I'd be reenacting bits from that, which
that
would probably
like
be really creepy for you.
Family Law role play? Okay, that is weird.
Ben, you're here for the Writers Festival. How is everything else going in your mad life at the moment?
Oh, it's good. I'm really excited about the Writers Festival because tonight, well, at least when we're recording this, I'm going to be interviewing Ted Chiang, the short story writer from America who wrote Story of Your Life, which became Arrival, like one of my favorite films of the last probably 10 years. The one with Amy Adams and the aliens that look like squids.
And the circle writing.
Yeah, the circle writing.
Great soundtrack. Amy Adams is so good. She's my spirit animal this week. We just finished out
Stranger. This week? You get a new one each week?
Yeah, that's how it works when you're the boss.
Who was it last week?
Sorry?
Who was your spirit animal last week?
We'll talk about it later. Laura, how are you going?
I'm good. I just got back from a week in Sydney. Ben, you and I were just chatting about how the positives and negatives.
Unseasonably warm.
Yes, unseasonably warm, and how short-term Laura is very happy to be in the balmy, warm weather, and long-term Lara is recognizing that we're all going to die in a fiery pit of hell because of climate change. But Sydney was lovely. We did a bunch of open tab sessions, which is the sort of IRL version of the podcast, and it was wonderful.
Well, let's get stuck straight into it with our first link for the week. And Laura, this comes to you from ArtNet, and this is one of my favorite pieces this week. Tell us a bit more about it.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think most people listening will already know about this, but I'm so eager to discuss it with the two of you. So I read a lot. Ben, I'm sure you read a lot. Jeremy, I know you skim read a lot. We argue about it constantly. But there is no denying that overall long form reading is down. Even, I mean, myself, I was so addicted to books in my youth. I devoured books like they were crispy Macca's hash browns. But while I still read books, the amount has definitely plummeted in comparison to how I read as a kid. And now I read maybe like 900 million articles a day online. And then if I'm lucky, 10 minutes of a book before I pass out at night in bed. So short attention spans, increased phone usage, they go hand in hand. And we are constantly bombarded with easily consumable content and our attention is ever more divided. So in an effort to encourage the digital generation to read more, the New York Public Library has launched this new InstaNovels initiative where they are bringing literary classics to the digital masses via the wonder of Instagram stories. And they've enlisted the help of creative agency Mother for this, who've done a fabulous job. And they've teamed with various artists across the globe to convert classic novels into these animated, interactive Insta stories. And they've been quite clear about the fact as well that they specifically sought out artists who already have a strong Instagram presence to sort of help bolster the success of the campaign. So, of course, yeah, stories. They normally disappear after 24 hours, but Instagram semi-recently added their highlights feature that allows you to save stories and feature them on your profile. So essentially, they've kind of turned the library's account into a digital bookshelf of sorts. Now, just for anyone listening who wants to look at the same time, it's at NYPL for New York Public Library.
Or if you're listening to this on an enhanced podcatcher, you can view some of the stills we'll be chucking on
there. Yeah, true. Stay on us. Don't leave. Never leave. Please never leave. The program, it launched last week with part one of Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which is just my most favorite book of all time that I have reread and reread and reread.
Have you been to the Acme exhibition?
I haven't.
It's on right now.
Ah, good plug for Acme. I definitely need to check it out because I'm just... Oh, anyway, that book, it means so much to me. And the artwork was by an artist called Magos. And then that's going to be followed up in the coming months with The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, with artwork by Buck, and The Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka, with artwork by Cesar Pellicer. And then if that experiment is successful, the plan is to definitely add more novels down the track. So the first thing that I found really interesting was just to see stories, like the story's function being used in a new way. I mean, I'm a big fan of stories. I use it a ton. And I think I've probably posted like 3 photos to Instagram in the old way since Stories was released. So, I mean, and I guess although it's designed to be this ephemeral thing, I myself haven't, and I've also seen others using the feature to write sort of long chunks of text with the knowledge that people can hold down on the image to stop it from disappearing. But I still always thought about them always as temporary, these sort of throwaway things. Whereas here, the library are really using it in a totally novel way. Pardon the pun. But yes, look, basically for context, the way it works is that users can flick through the animated visuals and text in essentially the same way that they would on an e-reader device. There's sort of various images and chapter headings and then just pages of pages upon text like a regular book, with the odd sort of animated flourish here or there. And in the bottom, there's a little space reserved for the reader to pop their thumb so that the story pauses and allows them to read it at their own pace. Mm. And the library has stated that the goal here is to basically preserve the value and education of reading, to encourage people to read more, and most importantly, to act as a bit of a gateway drug for non-Instagram-based reading and basically sort of plug their ebook platform. And before we talk about whether or not we think that the campaign will achieve that goal, I do want to acknowledge that it is a really clever use of technology. I mean, trying to turn what's normally very fast-paced, bite-sized content and slowing that right down into, you know, turning into something else. I think either way, I just really applaud them for trying when most other institutions are probably sort of ignoring the problem. And I mean, Instagram has, what, 1 billion users, 400 million people looking at it every day. And the New York Public Library themselves, like, certainly weren't doing too shabby in terms of their online following already. They've got a pretty robust 2.5 million Twitter followers, a couple of podcasts, and they already had around 200,000 Instagram followers, I believe. And by the looks of it, this campaign is pretty promising so far. I mean, at least in terms of PR. On the first day alone, I read that they had more than 450,000 impressions on the stories. They gained around 7,000 followers. And keep in mind, it's been a week since then, and this initiative has been reported on by every single bloody outlet in the universe. I've just seen it everywhere. And from what I can tell, the library have gained another 30 or 40,000 followers in the last week, which is kind of insane. But I guess the question that I have is, well, does that actually translate into people reading more books? Like, does it achieve the goals that the campaign sets out to, you know, to achieve? And I'm sure that if it is successful, they will release stats on that eventually, because that stuff is very measurable. But I want to know, like, how do you guys feel about this? And do you think that this will encourage people on an ongoing basis that wouldn't traditionally interact with this type of literature?
Well, I'm going to flip the question back to you, Lara, which is you do like to read already. And you also like Instagram stories. So have you had a flick, and is this a way in which you'd actually like to read a narrative form of fiction?
That's a really tricky one for me, because I did have a flick through. I love the concept, but I have to say I didn't sit and read it, which I think is how a lot of people are engaging with it, right?
Oh, well, you're telling me an ad agency came up with a concept that people actually didn't engage with.
I know, it's crazy. But I think as well, the other thing for me is that I have shitty eyesight. And so I was like, this is small, and I just kind of was like, I turned into an 8-year-old when I looked at it.
Because I really like reading. I really like Instagram stories as well. But I'm wondering whether in practice this is operating two very different muscles in our brain. You know, when I want to read, it's something that's immersive. When I'm going through Instagram stories, I'm being an absolute visual slut. Like, I'm just like flicking through stuff that I'm barely even digesting.
That should go on your gravestone. Ben Law, like, visual slut.
Completely. Like, I'm vacuuming just stuff at a really rapid pace. And my brain is working, I think, in a very different way to when I'm actually reading something like a novel. So I actually wonder whether the ad agency and the creatives involved in this, whether their aim was to actually get people reading, or whether their aim was to get people, like you say, engaged in the library's account, in which case it's actually seem to be really successful, right?
Absolutely. I guess my question is, like, does it go beyond, I think of the amount of accounts I've followed when there's been some interesting campaign or whatever, and I hit follow, and then that's the last time I ever engage with them, you know, because I just kind of, I wanted to be part of that singular campaign.
But
thing
if you follow them, they're going to come back up, right? You're going to see them in your feed again.
Yeah.
The New York Public Library, from what I also understand, they've just had like a recent documentary about them that's come out in the US too. So they're obviously on some sort of huge publicity push get people involved in, let's face it, a very precious and rare public asset that, you know, increasingly, I don't know whether people value libraries as much as they used to.
Which is crazy. Libraries are so cool.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of, like, the amount of stuff you can get for free is wild.
DVDs. Yeah. There's a library over at the port. It's like the wharf side of Melbourne. I don't live here. I did a talk there once.
About. It's a beautiful, beautiful space.
There's a recording studio there. You can book it as a band for free to record an album in a library. So, and also the other thing is, as much as I talk about, I wonder whether people engage with libraries as much. In Australia, at least, there are actually more libraries in this country than there are McDonald's. So we actually do quite well
at
libraries.
That's a lovely stat.
And we do like them.
That warms my soul, I think, because we often look at some pretty depressing stats on this show, and that's nice. I'm going to keep that one with me and just hold it tight. I think, yeah, I mean, you make a really good point. Just in general, libraries have become places that offer a lot more than books. I mean, increasingly, they're places where sort of all sectors of society can connect to the web. Many sometimes now offer like refuges for the homeless. There's lots of like children's activities.
If you need a place to look at porn and want to get on Brown Cardigan,
that's where Jeremy goes.
The 10-minute timer on the library.
One stone. Like, come on.
Glad you're not doing it in the office, Jeremy. But yeah, I mean, it's at the same time, I don't remember the last time I went to a library.
But at the same time, I think libraries come and go in our lives. For instance, all of my friends who are young parents at the moment, they have rediscovered the library because you need to churn through a lot of kids' books, right? And you don't necessarily want to buy like $5, $20 kids' books a week. The library is this magical place filled with saliva, filled, chewed picture books ready for you to hire.
And you're really selling it.
Oh, yeah. No, even like on ebooks as well. Like, you know, my friends moved out to the States to build this platform called Libby, which is like an ebook kind of loaner. It's like, you know, you can actually get ebooks as well, like without even having to go to the library. Anyway, this is turning into real pro-library propaganda over here.
I've been watching Parks and Rec at the moment, and this is making me laugh because they're so anti-library in that show. But the library is the devil.
Look, I think it's a great tool. It's been an interesting week for libraries in the States in general. Like, the Library of Congress had a big redesign that Pentagram did, which I think is the worst thing ever. It is so bad. And I was going to actually kind of talk about that to round it up, but I was too excited about my link. But yeah, look, I think it was interesting. I think it's great as well, like, to see libraries working with ad agencies kind of in this way.
Yeah, I mean, there've been other experiments like this. There was an ambitious project in the UK called Ambient Literature that used like location and weather data to make the content specific to each reader.
Wow.
For pieces. So, and obviously that's something that is, of course, only possible in on-screen reading. You know, you can't do that with a hardcover book. And then there was another initiative also for the New York Public Library a while ago that was proposed by some students from Miami Ad School. And there was a sort of virtual library shelf on the subway, and passengers could like read the first 10 pages of a book on their phones before being directed to the nearest library to pick up a copy. And it was kind of clever because this is when there was no internet service on the subway, when you were like underground. And so they did this using, what's that thing? NFP or what's that? You know, the tech, you know, the
NFP, that's right.
Yeah, got it.
NFC, sorry.
NFC.
Near Field Communications.
Oh, so close. Neil Patrick Harris. anyway, sorry. Yeah, they did it using that. So people kind of had no other option. They couldn't look at Instagram, whatever. So they maybe interacted with this. And then like in Japan, novels that are designed specifically to be read on smartphones have been popular for quite some time. I mean, I think that also partly relates to the fact that like Japanese grammar lends itself better than English to the kind of sort of short sentences that writing on a phone
requires. Manga,
for
instance, is like huge on a smartphone.
Absolutely. And that's got a lot to do with language, you know, and the way that it's constructed versus English. But there's still, I think, ways to make English sort of function within that space. And we're kind of seeing people do that, which is interesting.
I think, the final point I'll make is just kind of in terms of the content that they're using as well, in terms of whether kind of classics are the right material to launch something like this with. And I kind of, you know, when we did our field guide, we kind of did something similar where we wanted to repurpose a piece of literature and kind of give a story, you know, with our promos. And so we use Project Gutenberg to find out, okay, well, what work is in kind of the public domain? And I kind of feel it's, even though there's a lot of stuff there, it is also kind of really limited. And I think it would be a bit more interesting if they were working with, I guess, younger writers or
you know, commissioning new content.
Commissioning new content as well. Like, you know, because they've obviously put a lot of kind of money into the actual production of Here. So I'm surprised they just
didn't
go that
step further. But like, if they were commissioning new content, then people couldn't go to the library to get that out.
This is very true.
This is what makes me think that ultimately it's about driving eyeballs to the library rather than the text itself, because they're piggybacking on artist success. And I say that in a non-cynical way.
Oh, like, yeah.
Cleverly.
That's the point, yeah.
Piggybacking on artists and therefore piggybacking on, you know, one of the most iconic and beloved stories of our time, which is Alice in Wonderland. So all that kind of recognition is about getting eyeballs and engagement with the library itself, I think.
And for writers as well, having their books in libraries is a huge source of income as well. And I kind of think, that came up in the copyright debate that we were talking about the other week in terms of the whole ELR, PLR in Australia and the US. So a lot of interesting stuff happening in the space. So yeah, Laura, thanks for bringing that link to our attention.
You are welcome.
And we will move on from there. Next up, my link for the week. Oh my God, I'm so excited about this. I just want my whole life to be about this link. And this is kind of where, this is just where I think the internet is kind of at its best. And it is someone kind of just uncovered I feel like if I'm talking to somebody in architecture, like this might just be like, oh yeah, like you didn't kind of know about that. But it's kind of one of these things where like all kind of internet kind of memes or kind of waves, it comes in waves. And three people kind of were posting photos of this. And what it is it's a department store called Best Superstores. And it's a series of photos of their stores. And the stores are just kind of mind bending. It's like, we'll post some kind of links to the enhanced content if you're on an enhanced podcatcher. But basically, I don't even know how to kind of describe it. It was a real unique collaboration between the architecture firm Site. This architecture firm Site, founded in 1970 by a bunch of artists, he got to this point where he was a really successful sculptor, but he said he felt he was designing turds in a plaza and he wanted to be free of the form. And so together with some of the patrons of his practice who were running these kind of department stores, which are kind of like IKEA, I guess at the time, just kind of like a big box department store, they pretty much were his patrons to create these new kind of these buildings, which became these destinations, these architectural destinations for the shops. It's so hard to describe, but one of them is called the Peeling Building, where it literally looks like the facade is like just peeling off of the kind of foundation.
And it's worth noting as well, like the buildings, apart from the one thing that's like off about them, the one sort of glitchy thing, you know, they look like the most boring box buildings, you know, and I think that's part of the charm, is that they appear on the face like these just brick boxes, and then they've got this some kind of crazy, like, yeah.
And when you see the photos as well, and you see them in context with other stores of the time, like it's clear like what era this was. I mean, this was kind of in the 70s, and like I can't imagine the scale that these things were operating on. One of their buildings was almost kind of looks like what the Apple stores kind of look like now, like just so contemporary, like this fresh box. But then another one literally had this kind of moving brick facade, like the one that the balloons
are
coming out of.
Yeah, where the whole corner comes out.
The whole corner kind of comes.
It looks like the building's breaking open. It's crazy.
And they've all been demolished except for one, which was called the Forest Building, which was actually designed to kind of look like this kind of post-apocalyptic, you know, just abandoned building in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it was just this amazing union of art and commerce, which is just like kind of my total bag. When I see this happening, it just makes me so happy. Two of my favorite pieces of art. Do you guys know the Prada Marfa? This is in Texas, just off US Highway 90. These two artists, Elm Green and Dragset, actually built a Prada store in 2005. It's just in the middle of the desert. It's just kind of there. Yeah. And there's kind of stuff in there from the Prada collection this year. And there's also Callum Morton's hotel piece, you know,
yes,
on the East
Link.
Yes,
I love that.
So it's like, I love pieces of art that are just really, really kind of big and kind of, you know, feel just strange. And I love that this was actually done in this kind of commercial way. And these stores actually ended up being their most successful stores. So they really drew people to the location. And yeah, just everything about it I love. And it was just kind of like, I can't believe this hasn't happened more, that I never kind of knew about it. So yeah.
I mean, it makes me think, I mean, not quite in the same level of like impressiveness, but it makes me think of like the Lego stores, whatever, where they've got like the crazy in Times Square, where they've got the crazy like sculptures built out of all the Lego and sort of bits and pieces like that, but nothing quite on this kind of scale and not this kind of permanence. Like, I mean, they've all been torn down, so I guess not that permanent, but I mean, when they were building it, in mind, they're building the whole structure of the building. It's not like some shifting campaign or window display that can be sort of changed the next week.
It's something that people are doing a lot now. And the reason I think this was in my head is because what's the thing in Melbourne that they're doing in the old Adidas?
Sugar Republic.
And in America, in San Francisco, is the Color Factory. And now it's kind of moving.
There's Dream Machine in New York. So there's this whole idea of kind rooms,
of people are kind of creating.
Museum of Ice Cream.
Yeah, creating these kind of experiences that simply just go for you to kind of Instagram. But this, you know, these shops, like none of that kind of exists. You had to go and have this kind of physical experience.
Yeah, I think what you've uncovered here feels kind of different to that stuff.
Does it?
Yeah, to me it does. I think since you sent this link through, I've been trying to like really break down internally like why it feels different to me and if it is different or if I'm just sort of looking at it as like the good old days and like everything's ruined now, you know? And I think it is different to me because it was a different time. And I think because the initial catalyst for these was to create art, not necessarily as a PR thing, although it became like they realized it was great for their marketing, whatever. I think initially they were big art collectors. They loved his work and they used this as an excuse to create an amazing piece. When you sort of contrast that with Sugar Republic around the corner that is purely just a way to like charge money so that people can come and get like Instagram selfies. Like, I don't know. That feels completely different.
Yeah, it's just a rare thing. It's kind of like David Walsh and other people who just kind of like have a lot of money and are also a bit crazy and like they decide to kind of live their own best lives like in this kind of way.
Absolutely.
Working with art.
It depends on the underlying level of like commerciality, is that a word?
No.
You know what I mean? Like I don't know.
Well, look, I mean, there's two questions I want to ask kind of each of you. And the first one is like, I want to have my mind blown a bit more. Have you guys ever seen anything like this at all? Like in, you know, either locally or abroad? Like what does this kind of remind you of?
The only thing that it reminds me of, and this is such like an anemic comparison, is the fact that all suburban Pizza Huts had the same shape in Australia. Did they have the same shape in America?
Oh, yeah. There's like 12 tumblers about this, which is like what became of those of Pizza those. Huts.
Yes, and you some can like see other businesses
car
randomly
washes
now.
And all that sort of stuff. But I just remembered thinking, like, that was something that you took for granted, that built into the architecture was the branding itself, similar to what's happening here, right? But that's something that's, I don't know, like, that's from another era now.
Well, what about, like, the big banana and the big, like, that's, like, such an Australian thing.
I mean, I grew up in Queensland, so you're talking to the right demographic. Like, we owned all of that shit. Like, the big pineapple was like a 15-minute drive away from my house.
Have you guys ever seen, there's a Wikipedia list of all the big things in Australia, and like, there's all the ones that we all know about, and then there's like 300 more that are, some are not that big, but it's crazy. There's literally the big everything you could ever imagine.
And I kind of consider that a very Australian thing. Like,
oh, it's brutally Australian in the best possible way.
And like, there's also the big Uluru that it has an arcade in it somewhere.
Oh,
as well.
Really?
Yeah. Like,
that just sounds really not quite right.
There's some issues there.
There's definitely a lot of issues there.
It's funny you bring up David Walsh because like it reminded me of Mona. I mean, when they first released the sort of images of and the designs of Mona, I was blown. And when I first went there and I saw the way it was built into the cliff face, like that was crazy to me. Like I'd never seen or experienced anything like that. And I mean, it's obviously quite a different style of design to what we're looking at here, but I had that same feeling of like, this is an enormous, like essentially a commercial thing. It's an art gallery, but it's a commercial thing. And I love that they've done this, that they've gone so wild when they didn't necessarily have to. And I think that's what I love about this. Like they could have done something less mental with these best stores, but they didn't. They poured their money into doing this and they trusted this guy. I think I come from it as the perspective as an artist agent and like, imagine if we could convince a client to let us do things that are this crazy. You know, the fact that they had this kind of trust to do this is nuts.
Well, I love that it's weird. And like, there's this quote that's been going around on everyone's Instagram the last few weeks. I don't know if you've seen this from Ezra Croft. She's an art show producer. And they say, people need art in their houses. They don't need Bed Bath & Beyond dentist office art. They need weird stuff. And I just love that kind of sentiment. And I love it seeing it kind of play out in this way. Sorry, Ben, were you about to say something that I was going to cut you off on?
I think what the interesting thing is about these best stores, though, is that it's appealing to this suburban ordinariness. Like when you talk about Mona, that's kind of explicitly sublime in its own way. It's epic. Whereas, you know, a best store just doing this, like out in the suburbs of, I don't know, Houston or whatever, like that is singularly funny and bizarre. And I'm not sure anything does compare to this particular.
Absolutely. Because there might be architecture that's similarly, either similar in style or similarly bizarre, but not similar in context. I think there's private architecture that could be as wowing, but not the reason this is so wonderful and surreal is that it was a best store. That's the thing that I love about this. It reminds me of the NSA posters we were looking at a while ago, which is still just my favorite thing ever, when they uncovered all these like NSA posters from the 50s and 60s that are just bizarre and wonderful. And the fact that it came from the NSA is what made it kind of so magical for me. And I mean, we're talking about whether there is a difference between this and sort of Sugar Republic stuff, and I find it so hard to figure out my feelings on that. But I do guess I have to realize and acknowledge that often the only time that something this massive is accomplishable is when there's a commercial marketing budget behind it. You know, like art for art's sake isn't usually possible at this sort of scale.
Oh, like I can't imagine this being done today for a number of health and safety violations as well, like with all the bricks is kind of being piled up there as well. Mm-hmm. But also, like, you know, the sheer cost of kind of building things and how the building and architecture industry works at the moment. I mean, yeah, there's a lot that is really kind of special about this. But I think, Ben, the last question I wanted to just ask you about this is, look, working in the visual arts, it's exciting how many opportunities exist to put work in the public sphere, especially working along more traditional activities like Laura's talking about. I mean, architecture and sculpture often go hand in hand with big business. Any corporate headquarters can attest to that, even if there is a turd in the lobby there. But yeah, usually without much effect. And so, look, I mean, I'm just curious, like, as a writer, what's the equivalent in your industry to kind of public art? Like, is this something that you feel that you can interface with as a kind of creative? I just think, or is that kind of something that is kind of blocked off? Is there anything that's there?
Well, I mean, sometimes writing does manifest as public art. I think that, for instance, there's a gallery very close to where I live in Chippendale in Sydney called White Rabbit Gallery. And the owner of that gallery has kind of extended the premises to, I think, their own private premises. And there's like this insane water feature there that is engraved with Kate Bush lyrics, for instance. And I'm like, that's just there because, you know, and because why not? So I think like there's that. But I also think beyond that, it loops back to the other conversation which we're having, which I think the writerly manifestation of all of this is a library. Like when you think about it, a library is this incredible but slightly batshit insane idea that everyone will be able to access free of charge a complete bank of knowledge. And the fact that we've pulled that off, I mean, for all the other things that we've ruined as a species and a civilization.
And the list is long.
Exactly. But the fact that we still have libraries, I think, is kind of a really good yardstick in terms of what we can do.
Yeah. I mean, that's beautiful. And I'd like to thank the State Library for being our sponsor this week.
Sorry, Squarespace.
Yeah, these visual representations of the written word are quite striking. And I think that also, we've talked about this before, how kind of writing has become the new design unicorn skill, where every kind of writer, every designer kind of needs to be a writer, because I think the written word is so much of a part of, I mean, it's just so kind of married, especially in design, with everything, you know, that we do. They're just kind of,
well, and everything. I mean, I think about even just how we hire, like how high on the list, you know, competent writing is. And we always talk about that quote, is it from John Maeder? Who is it? Jason Fried or something that said that about like clear writing as a sign of clear thinking, and how, you know, that plays into almost everything that we do.
Well, look, and I think another interesting part, leaving on this last note, is just how this was really penned by a lot of architects at the time, kind of being seen as really kind of gimmicky in this way. And yeah, I guess I would love to hear from kind of any other architects who might listen to the show, or, you know, might have their own opinion. We're going to be putting up the links to both the kind of photos as well as the site website that has a much more kind of broad overview of some of the other work that you might not be able to see. So drop us a line at podcast@JackieWinter.com, and we will move on from there. And now for our final link. Ben, you have a bit of a 2-for-1 special this week, but I'm a bit curious as well. I like asking this of everybody. Where do you find your links? You know, you are a man on the go. You're a man that likes to read a lot as well. Are you a Twitter person? Do you do RSS? Where do you get it from?
Yeah, I'm a huge Twitter person, and anyone who follows my Twitter feed, I apologize, but you know, I'm a little bit voracious on that thing. Part of it has to do with the fact that I work completely by myself. So Twitter emulates a workplace for me, in all of its glory and its horror. But it's also a place for me to find new material as well. So every morning, my reading habit is I just open up my 7 main tabs of like the news sites that I read every day. So that's everything from the Sydney Morning Herald and the Guardian to the New York Times to whatever, ABC. And then beyond that, it's just really like mining. I think Facebook has dropped in primacy in terms of like discovering new stuff. I think it's kind of a mess, to be honest.
Yeah, it's not even good for like dog videos anymore.
Yeah, Twitter's a mess in a very, very different way, but it's still good for discovering like really random shit, because people retweet stuff into your feed immediately. The pieces, the links that I've brought through, are all about things falling apart. Because as a writer, I just find that really fascinating, the concept of failure, because I think writing, like a lot of artistic disciplines really, but writing especially, is minute by minute failure. You're like constantly editing, you're going back, that doesn't work, you try something else, you delete it, you cut, you paste. Like everything is actually failure until you've got the sentence right.
And then you send it to your editor and it's
failure
again.
Yeah, and then there's more failure again, because it's just like, actually, no, we need to change this and this and this, and you've gotten your facts completely wrong and you're about to be sued. And so, full disclosure, my partner has started a project at the ABC called ABC Life. So I've been reading about ABC.net.au/life. And this has been a kind of a project that's been in development for almost a year now, where the ABC has kind of identified that they've, you know, the ABC has been helping people with their lives on TV and radio for a really long time, from Gardening Australia to Life Matters. But let's face it, like, that kind of stuff is usually for a very particular demographic that's definitely older than mine. And when it comes to like life advice, the stuff that we find online usually has a commercial imperative, and the ABC is in a very good position to provide stuff that doesn't have that. And one of the things that caught my eye this week, because it kind of both consolidates like life stuff, but it brings into it a political conversation, because it's all about what happens when workplace relationships break down. Now, as I said before, I don't have a workplace, so I find workplaces fascinating. I'm at the ABC once a week, and when there's like an open plan, and I'm still getting used to like, am I allowed to talk to you now? Oh, you're talking to me. You're talking to me. Oh, should I keep talking? Oh, maybe you want to do work. It's like, I don't know how to like negotiate or navigate.
Well, and every workplace has its own bizarre politics, dynamics, completely. Ecosystem. Yeah.
And so for me, I just imagine like it's a miracle when any workplace functions whatsoever. Like my perfect workplace is the workplace I've got. It's just one person going insane in his own time. But when you've got like a lot
sounds healthy.
Yeah, but when you've got a lot of people, it's kind of like a family. You haven't been the one who's chosen to necessarily be around these people unless you're the boss. And even then, you know, that you're not just necessarily hiring people for like temperament. This has to be an ecosystem that works, but you've got a lot of different personalities in the room. And so I just really like this piece by Scott Mitchell, which is just really interesting case studies and practical advice about what happens when that all falls apart. And in the first few parts, like there's like this relationship, professional relationship specialist who says, yeah, I'm actually dealing with people and we're just going to have to dissolve the workplace. Like that's fascinating that a professional can come in and say, this is irrevocably shit. It is just never going to work. And that happens in some families.
That's got to be a toxic workplace.
Absolutely. If that happens in families, and we know that it does, why wouldn't it happen in a workplace? I just think we don't talk about the impossibility and the challenges in front of us when we're working in a workplace. I thought this was really interesting.
Yeah, I was interested that you picked it because, like you say, you are kind of a freelancer. I mean, at Twitter, if you said Twitter is your workplace, then yeah, it's a definite toxic workplace over there. As someone who does kind of hire people, I've always found that process really interesting because, like, you know, even like in a one-on-one romantic relationship, like the amount of communication that's required for that to kind of thrive is really hard, especially if you don't like conflict like me. And when you're hiring somebody, you have maybe, I don't know, an hour or 2 hours kind of with them, with kind of people they know. And then you're spending more time with them than you are sometimes with your partner. It is really hard.
It's really hard. It's definitely something that we've always been like, well, you, Jeremy, and all of us, when you involve us in sort of parts of the decisions, that really, really, really conscious of how, obviously you're looking for someone who's going to be really competent at the job, but also how that their energy, their style of working, their style of being is going to fit in with the rest, and not just for our happiness, but for theirs, you know, and especially crucial in a workplace that is as small and tight knit at ours. Like, sometimes you've got these companies that are like 300, 400 people and you can kind of avoid someone if you need to, but we're like, what, 12 people in a room? It's
And plus you add Slack and email to that. Like, I have never worked, actually, I mean, do you remember working before like phones and stuff? Like, were any of you like around?
I was
that
not.
For that time?
I was not
like,
around.
I was.
I didn't.
Tell me about the old days, Jeremy. Well, what was it like? Was it black and white?
It was. Let me tell you. Gather around.
Riding a dinosaur to work.
Ben, what I'm really interested about is kind of like how this workplace works for you as a freelancer. I mean, we effectively manage a freelance workforce, like with our kind of artists. So your workforce is kind of so distributed in that way. Do you kind of see any of these things that are talked about that happen in a workplace, but I guess represented in kind of a more decentralized way with your clients or your other professional networks there?
Well, it's more about the community for writers. So the reason a lot of us stay on Twitter is we're working in our own spaces, but we want to have conversations about the same things that we're going through, which is we've got a really tough assignment or we've got to prepare for these writers' festivals or whatever. So there's that. And within a very tight kind of community or environment, this toxic stuff can come up as well. So I know writers who have had huge, sometimes public fallings out online in essentially what I think is, almost a replication of a digital workplace. As much as, we're not collaborating with each other directly, we're a part of a cluster of people working towards the same thing. So to see that happen and then to read this article, I thought it was really interesting where they said, when things go wrong, usually it's about people seeing that trust has completely dissolved. And when you brought up competence before, like that's the one of the ways that this article talks about the way trust can devolve. It's about competence, it's about care, and it's about fairness. And if you violate any of those things or are perceived to, then the trust completely erodes and you've got a really sticky situation on your hands. So it's interesting
really
to get the breakdown
that
the architecture of it. Yeah.
Because I mean, I think the longer you work at all, not necessarily in the single workplace, just at all, the longer that you're in the industry and you are challenged by different sort of types of people and types of working, realize that trust is absolutely what it comes down to. I think it's like, I think you can respect someone and not necessarily get along, and then it's fine. But if you don't respect what they do or you don't have that, then it's really hard to be around them in the workplace.
In that case, you don't trust their judgment. And so, and the other piece that I brought up was this New York Times piece called Talking About Failure is Crucial for Growth. Here's how to do it right. The New York Times over the last few years has done really well with its Smarter Living section. So obviously, newspaper
Fantastic
of record,
stuff.
They're going to be doing Pulitzer Prize winning journalism. But beyond that,
fake news.
The kind of lifestyle. I mean, so often we associate lifestyle with like holidays to go on. But usually I think like the most important life content is like, this is how to navigate like your everyday life. That's the stuff I think, not to escape it, but to actually face it and to face something like failure, which is something we probably do every day of our lives.
I know I do.
Yeah, but we don't talk about it. And so all of this, I think, connects with each other. Like when a workplace fails or when a workplace culture has gotten toxic, that's a failure of some nature. And probably what has led to it is a lack of communication about failure, because to discuss failure is to amplify shame, and we don't like doing that. So I think these instructional pieces are actually quite interesting for me, just as someone of my professional community, but also someone, just as a human being, to try to get around those inevitable things we face rather than avoid them, looking them directly in the eye.
Well, I love that they talk about here the benefits of discussing failure openly with your colleagues, because and how you can all sort of learn from that. And I think I feel really hashtag blessed to be in a workplace where we do actively do that. And that comes very much from being in a space where you feel comfortable to do that without judgment or fear of losing your job, which comes back to trust. Like if someone here talks about something they failed in, the reaction is, oh, how can we, not pointing your finger at you and like, you failed, that would be a very different situation. But I think, I guess for you, you don't have a team of colleagues that you can sit down and like debrief with and sort of say like, how could I have done that better? And so what do you do?
I've got a lot of professional obligations as anyone does with a job, but without those people working alongside
me, the system.
Where I'm like, help. So the first thing is forming those tight communities, whether digital or in real life. And yes, of course, I've got the people in my outer circle and people in my inner circle that where I'm really going to say, I have monumentally fucked up and I really need either sympathy or advice or possibly both. My partner is a really good sounding board. So at the end of the day, like, we just decompress, which is good because I think the way that I'm hardwired, my instinct is just to just bury it. You know, if I don't talk about it, then it will just go away.
It's a very waspy of
you. It's a very male thing, but I also think maybe it's a Chinese thing. You know, swallow your shame and eat bitterness. Yeah.
You know, see, the rest of my family are very Catholic, Latin Catholic. Uh-huh. So you're meant to express the shame and then feel it.
Oh,
just feel the guilt. Yeah.
Let it corrode your system. I think it's about communicating that more. And I think different jobs have actually made me realize that, like, for instance, when I'm in a writer's room for a television show, when you're pitching ideas to the whiteboard and the group, everything, like basically nearly everything, doesn't work. Like 95% of your ideas just won't work and they'll get shut down. And so to get used to that, to get used to failure and to be actively seeing it happen in real time, I think is kind of healthy.
Mm, immersion therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've had our little taste of failure over the last month. It sucks.
What did we fail at?
Well, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Stuff.
That one. I can see it in front of me right now.
Ben, thank you so much for that. Really fascinating. We'll post all those up in our show notes as always. Before we go, it is time for, drumroll please, the brilliantly named Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, and completely petty off our chest. Why? Because, well, no one will listen to us. Some people listen to us, but not everybody.
I make Dan listen to me.
Laura, thumbs up or thumbs down this week? What do you got?
Guess.
Shaka?
We should introduce thumbs up, thumbs down, or shaka. No, it's a definite thumbs down. And I was going to talk about something different, but then Ben revealed to me that he also has an interest in public transport infrastructure.
Yay.
So I have a thumbs up and a thumbs down, actually.
Yes.
I've got a thumbs down for the person who is eating. You know what? I cannot stand Lord of the Fries on the train.
Mm.
It is horrendous. The smell is so brutal. I can stand almost anything else.
You can eat on Melbourne trains.
You can eat on Melbourne trains.
Yeah.
You shouldn't.
You can't. Sydney trains.
Like, I don't care. If someone's eating like a sandwich, whatever. But like, Lord of the Fries has this distinctive just odor that burns you from the inside out. So anyway, that's my thumbs down. But my thumbs up is the new Melbourne rail thing. Have you seen this?
Yeah. It's
I didn't
the
explain
loop.
It very well. The regional loop something.
Yeah, but they're
finally, for anyone who's not from Melbourne, there's a very annoying thing where you basically, if you're coming from any of the outer areas and you want to go to the other outer areas, you have to go into the city and then back out
Your
again.
Your train network is kind of like a star.
It's a star.
Burst.
Exactly. Yep. It's an asterisk thing, you know, because you have to go into the center and out again. And they're finally building like a circle to make it like a spider web.
Yeah.
You know, so that they join up.
Not everyone wants to come into the city anyway.
No. And it will free up some of the train seats. And I'm very, very
and
excited.
Part of that network, by the time they start building it, will be the infrastructure they're creating to the airport.
I'm sure that our very stable federal government will ensure this gets happening in no time kind of whatsoever. Ben, what about you? Thumbs up or thumbs down? Where are you at this week? Anything you'd like to either endorse or air a grievance of?
No, I don't know. Probably just the Australian political moment. And that's a big thumbs down, not just from me, but from everyone.
I'd be really worried if you were about to say it's a thumbs up. I was like, just want to say I'm really happy about everything that has gone on this week.
It's a thumbs up because you can see the demise of an era, but it's not a happy thumbs up. It's kind of been ongoing. And it kind of means that when it comes to big policy things, whether it's the arts or business or public transport infrastructure, we're not doing anything long term. And
no, it's just bickering. Although big thumbs up, the only thumbs up from all of this, I think, is the brilliant comedy and satire that has come out of like SBS and ABC as a result.
It's been gold.
Oh, almost worth it.
Oh,
Jeremy?
No, what's this kind of weird think tank? That's
the Institute of Public Affairs, the IPA. That looked like a Tonightly sketch and it was actually real.
Yeah. Horrifying times. Jeremy, thumbs up, thumbs down.
Oh man, there's so many tweets I want to read right now in public, but anyway, we'll come back to that. I have a thumbs up. This is something I didn't get to fit into my segment, so it's a bit of a epilogue.
You're just bringing an extra link.
I'm bringing an extra link.
You do this every week, Jeremy.
I know, I'm link greedy, but this
link
is,
slut.
I am a link slut. This is another piece of public art. And I think, again, someone kind of doing something really interesting. This is a piece in Edmonton, and it's a glitch sculpture called Carbon Copy. It's done by a series of artists who kind of took this like 1980s Plymouth car and basically made it kind of glitch by kind of cutting it in kind of slices and then kind of repositioning it and then just kind of hanging it kind of nose down in the middle of the sidewalk. Anyway, what's really kind of nice about it as well is just that they've kind of taken you behind the scenes. And there's a dedicated site kind of just for this that kind of goes into everything and just kind of shows how they kind of made it. And it's just one of those things I look at and just, you know, it makes me happy. I like when I walk around the street and I kind of see weird things with everything else on fire. It's nice to kind of have a bit of art in our life. So I think we'll leave it there. Ben, if people want to find out more about you, everything that you do, including all the julienne slices, where would they do that?
My website is benjamin-law.com. My Twitter and Instagram is at Mr. Benjamin Law. Apologies in advance for what you'll find there.
Ben, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Laura.
You are welcome.
I'm Jeremy Wartzman, she's Laura Chan Baker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more of the podcast, archives of all of our shows and the links we cover can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. To receive the links we talk about in the show each week in one neat little package, you can sign up to our podcast newsletter at tinyletter.com/Jackie Winter. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter, that's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season, and hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. If you love what you hear, subscribe, rate, leave us a comment on iTunes, and of course, recommend us to all your friends and family and people who even won't listen to you after you keep shouting about how much you love the show. As well as iTunes, they can get the show wherever you get podcasts, including Spotify and Stitcher, or for the traditionalists, directly from our website. Remember that this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, or Castro, you'll be able to see links to the articles as we're talking about them right on your screen. And if you work for an ad agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Laura harmonizes me here. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Bye.
With a bit of a bio, whatever, and then he'll bring you in, and that'll be obvious because he'll say something like, "Welcome to the show, Ben."
Oh,
exactly, and then all the sirens will go off, and yeah.